for news and information.
This is VOA News. I'm Tommy McNeil. Israel says it will respond to Iran's weekend attack despite growing international calls to step back. AP correspondent Sagar Magani.
Israel's defense chief says it's considering the next step, but says there will be a response without giving details. Israel is under heavy international pressure not to respond and further escalate the conflict from Washington.
Strength and wisdom need to be the same sides, the different sides of the same coin.
To London.
All sides must show restraint.
To Tehran itself. With Iran saying it does not want to escalate Mideast tensions. Sagar Magani, Washington.
A bakery in Gaza City has started operating for the first time in 6 months with aid from the World Food Program, providing desperately needed food in a part of the territory where UN-backed report has warned of imminent famine. Reuters correspondent Angela Johnston.
Abdul Rahman al-Jadba scored a bag of bread for his family. He says he had been forced to feed his children bread made with flour mixed with sand.
Our feeling after bread became available, it brought some sense of relief to be able to feed these children.
Israel has faced increased international pressure to let more aid into the Gaza Strip since it targeted an aid convoy on April 1st, killing international relief workers. The World Food Program says it's been using a new coordinated route to get aid into northern Gaza. It says it was able to make its first delivery to the bakery on Saturday with enough flour to make 14,000 bread parcels a day.
Pro-Palestinian demonstrators blocked roadways in Illinois, California, New York, and the Pacific Northwest on Monday, temporarily shutting down travel in some of the nation's most heavily used airports. This is VOA News. German Chancellor Olaf Scholz said he would discuss a just peace in Ukraine with Chinese President Xi Jinping as the two leaders met in Beijing. He says, my meeting with President Xi will also focus on how we can contribute more to a just peace in Ukraine, Scholz said in a post on social media platform X, adding there had been an intensive exchange between the governments since his last visit.
House Speaker Mike Johnson is pushing for votes this week on aid for Israel, Ukraine, and Taiwan.
There are precipitating events around the globe that we're all watching very carefully, and we know that the world is watching us.
Johnson plans to hold four separate votes on the package and leaves open the possibility of significant changes from the $95 billion aid package the Senate passed in February. But he's facing outright rebellion from conservatives. House Democrats could be open to helping Johnson and may even be agreeable to some Republican measures being discussed, such as providing some Ukraine aid as loans. Ben Thomas, Washington.
Former U.S. President and current presumptive presidential nominee Donald Trump's historic hush money trial got underway on Monday. The first day ended without any jurors being picked. AP correspondent Michael Sisak reports the jury selection effort proceeded slowly.
A panel of 96 Manhattan residents was brought into court for the beginning of jury selection in Donald Trump's criminal trial. Quickly, that was whittled to about a third. As the judge asked jurors if they could be fair and impartial, more than 50 raised their hands. And then nine more exited the courtroom after they said they couldn't serve for other reasons.
The U.S. Supreme Court is allowing Idaho to enforce its ban on gender-affirming care for transgender youth while lawsuits over the law proceed, reversing lower courts. The justices' order Monday allows the state to put in place a 2023 law that subjects physicians to up to 10 years in prison if they provide hormones, puberty blockers, or other gender-affirming care to people under the age of 18. Under the court's order, the two transgender teens who sued to challenge the law still will be able to get the care that they want or need. The court's three liberal justices would have kept the law on hold altogether. A federal judge in Idaho had blocked the law in its entirety, saying that it was necessary to do so to protect teens. You'll find more at voanews.com. I'm Tommy McNeil, VOA News.
says it will retaliate for Iran's attack.
Iran will face the consequences for its actions.
Ukrainian officials are voicing concern about future military support from the West, especially the United States.
The situation on the Eastern Front has deteriorated as Russia intensified its effort to gain more Ukrainian territory.
And a bakery in Gaza City opens for the first time in 6 months.
Our feeling after bread became available, it brought some sense of relief to be able to feed these children.
Today is Tuesday, April 16th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Scott Walterman. Israel says it will retaliate for Iran's attack. The Army Chief of Staff, Herzi Halevi, Monday said that Iran will face the consequences for its actions. International pressure is building on Israel to hold back in responding to Iran's attacks. But many Israelis are calling on the government to retaliate forcefully. For VOA from Jerusalem, Linda Gradstein reports on the intensifying debate.
Iran's attack with hundreds of missiles fired simultaneously was unprecedented. So was the international cooperation to intercept them, with the U.S., Jordan, and Britain working together, say Israeli security officials. As the international community urges restraint, some in Israel say the Jewish state must respond. Brigadier General Yossi Cooperwasser is a former senior military intelligence official.
I think that we cannot leave this open file without some retaliation. But the kind of retaliation is going to be measured in the sense that Israel doesn't want to lead to a regional war.
Israeli media reports say two former chiefs of staff in the war cabinet, Benny Gantz and Gadi Eisenkot, wanted to strike back at Iran while the Iranian attack was underway, but Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said no. Other Israeli intelligence analysts say the damage was limited and Israel can choose not to respond further. Seema Shain, an Iran specialist and former Mossad official, says Israel should build on the international cooperation against Iran.
Yeah, I'm sure Israel will be able in the future to retaliate in Iran in a different way. We have a lot of capabilities, and I think it will be much more devastating for the Iranians if Israel succeeded, and Israel has to contribute to that in order that it will work, succeed to change the architecture of the Middle East in a way that will be understood that Iran is with its proxies, but all the others are actually cooperating against Iran and its proxies.
Iran's attack came as Israel is under growing international criticism for the humanitarian crisis in Gaza that has left hundreds of thousands of Palestinians facing famine. The U.S. has been pushing Israel to accept a ceasefire that would lead to freedom for the remaining 129 Israeli hostages that Hamas militants took hostage on October 7th, although it's not clear how many are still alive. There is concern in Israel that retaliating against Iran could lead to even more pressure on Israel to withdraw from Gaza before it has reached its goals. Linda Gradstein, VOA News, Jerusalem.
We have some new details on the attack by Iran. Joining us now from the Pentagon is VOA's Carla Babb. All right, so we have some fresh detail. What did you learn?
That's right. So we're recently talking to Pentagon Press Secretary Pat Ryder at the briefing a few hours ago, and he was explaining that all in all, there were more than 300 air threats that were launched by Iran and its proxies on April 13th and 14th toward Israel. Now, the U.S. was able to destroy more than 80 one-way attack drones and 6 ballistic missiles, including one that was still on the launch vehicle in Iraq. And we have been told by officials that more than 99% of the attack drones and the missiles were shot down or failed to reach their targets. I have been told from an official that only about 5 ballistic missiles actually landed on Israeli territory.
With any accuracy, or they landed in places that didn't really affect anything?
did not cause a lot of damage. So this is being viewed by the U.S. and its allies as a major success. Let's not forget the U.S. was not the only one helping Israel out here. Israel has its own defenses, but then there were American fighter jets. There were American ships that were helping with this. There were British fighter jets. The French helped. The Jordanians were also shooting down some of those drones. And I've been told by an official that Saudi Arabia and the UAE were providing intel to help the allies shoot down these targets.
Now, this isn't the Iron Dome. This is something different, something new.
This is a coordinated effort by not just Israel's Iron Dome. You are exactly right there. General Kirilla, who is the head of U.S. Central Command, is in the theater, and I have been told by officials that he was helping to coordinate this defensive strategy, where it was clearly a group effort. Everyone came, all of these allies came to help Israel. They knew that there was going to be a big attack launched, and they were able to respond.
All right, we will stay on alert and talk to you if anything develops. Thanks.
You're welcome.
VOA's Pentagon correspondent, Carla Babb. So, despite the size of the Iranian assault on Israel, is Iran really looking to escalate the situation? VOA's Steve Karish, host of Flashpoint Global Crises, spoke with Alex Vatanka. He's director of the Iran program at the Middle East Institute.
Look, it was very clear after the Israeli strike on the Iranian embassy compound in Damascus on April 1st that Tehran had to retaliate. At least that's what they said they had to. And the Supreme Leader of the Islamic Republic, Ali Khamenei, made that point repeatedly. So he set the stage. Expectations were high. And yet, analysts know for a long time now that this is not exactly a regime that takes actions that might backfire in the sense of forcing the regime into a corner. So we anticipated a retaliation from Iran. But the number of drones, missiles that were launched at Israel did surprise me. And yet, what also surprised me was how it turned out they had gone out of their way to provide early warning, essentially to the Israelis through various intermediaries about what they intended to do. So did Iran want to damage Israel in one way or another? Absolutely. Did they want to strike Israel at the maximum that they could? It turns out, as of right now, that was probably not the case.
Why do you think that might be? Why were they holding back?
The one thing that seems to be the main factor here is this fear in the Islamic Republic of forcing the United States into the conflict on the side of Israel. That is their ultimate fear. It's not so much that they fear a head-to-head with the Israelis on their own. It's that they assume, probably correctly, that U.S. will quickly come to Israel's aid. And for that reason, they really had to act to save face after the attack in Damascus. But do so in a way that, you know, left space for the Israelis to climb down, for both sides to be able to essentially claim victory. And it's certainly, from Iran's point of view, hope that this is the end of it.
Alex Vatanka, director of the Iran program at the Middle East Institute, speaking with VOA's Steve Karish. While the Biden administration is telling Israel to stand down, former U.S. National Security Advisor John Bolton believes the opposite. Kasina Sokolyanskaya with VOA's sister network, Radio Free Europe, spoke with Bolton.
Ambassador Bolton, thank you for making time for us. Over the last weekend, you made several strong statements about the Iranian attack on Israel and the response, particularly calling President Biden an embarrassment to the U.S. Why do you think he is making wrong, weak moves?
Well, if the United States were attacked with 320-plus ballistic missiles, cruise missiles, and drones, we would retaliate. At a minimum, we would destroy the bases and the facilities from which the attacks were launched. We'd take out air defenses all around the country involved, Iran, whichever, to make sure our missiles and planes could get through. And I think we do more than that as well, especially in the case of Israel. They can't know whether the next ballistic missiles launched from Iran might not contain nuclear warheads.
There are growing calls among allies for restraint to avoid escalation. Are you sure that the strong response you are calling for won't cause the beginning of the next world war?
Well, I think that's extremely unlikely. I think the wider war that Biden and others are always saying they fear began on October the 7th. The administration has refused to look at the region in a strategic sense. This is not separate battles between Israel and Hamas in Gaza, or the Houthis trying to close the Red Sea and the Suez Canal to international commercial traffic. This is all controlled by Iran. These terrorist groups are all armed, equipped, trained, financed by Iran. Iran is the puppet master here. That's the wider war we're already in. The question is, can Iran continue to hold Israel hostage to the threat of ballistic missile attacks, or will Israel do something about it? I have no doubt that the Israelis are under intense pressure here, but I am firmly of the belief that if the U.S. faced that kind of attack, there's no doubt what we would do. Why should we deny the Israelis the right to do to react the same way we would?
Do you think that Iran is now a bigger threat to world peace than Russia?
Iran is run by a group of medieval religious fanatics aspiring to have nuclear weapons. They're a very dangerous power, and they are an outrider, an aspect of the Beijing-Moscow axis that has been forming. But Russia is a mature nuclear power with thousands of warheads and capable delivery systems, which Iran still doesn't have. It has engaged in unprovoked aggression against Ukraine twice now, 2014 and 2022, and neither Ukraine nor the West have responded effectively. So Russia remains the threat, particularly as this axis with China grows. And I think it will grow, and I think it's a threat until somehow the Putin regime is removed from power in Russia and democracy gets another chance. I don't know when that's going to occur. I'm not optimistic. I don't think things will change in Russia until it does.
Former U.S. National Security Advisor John Bolton speaking with Radio Free Europe's Kasina Sokolyanskaya. Following these other stories from around the world, Russia and Ukraine on Monday traded blame at the United Nations Security Council for the attacks on Europe's largest nuclear power plant. The head of the International Atomic Agency said the attack put the world dangerously close to a nuclear accident. Tesla is laying off more than 10% of its global workforce, according to an internal memo seen by the news service Reuters on Monday. Tesla grappling with falling sales, intensifying price wars. CEO Elon Musk said in a post on X, "About every 5 years, we need to reorganize and streamline the company for the next phase of growth." The historic hush money trial of Donald Trump got underway Monday, with the arduous process of selecting a jury to hear the case. He's charged with falsifying business records in order to stifle stories about his sex life. The day ended without any jurors being chosen. In our continuing coverage of the 2024 U.S. presidential election, since Russia's invasion of Ukraine more than 2 years ago, divisions have arisen between congressional Democrats and Republicans over sending military aid to Kyiv. VOA senior Washington correspondent Carolyn Pursuti explains how the two presidential frontrunners differ on how to handle the Russian war in Ukraine.
For 2 years, an all-out war in Ukraine. This week, the U.S. approved the sale of $138 million of upgraded equipment for Ukraine's Hawk air defense systems that counter Russian missile strikes. In his State of the Union last month, President Biden said Ukraine needs U.S. support to stand up to Russia's invasion.
If anybody in this room thinks Putin will stop at Ukraine, I assure you he will not.
Ukraine can stop Putin if we stand with Ukraine and provide the weapons that needs to defend itself.
Since the invasion began, the Biden administration has imposed sanctions on Russian individuals and entities and sent $75 billion in assistance to Ukraine. As the son of a Ukrainian immigrant, Stephen Cassells says he will vote for Biden.
Watching the war there and watching Putin and watching the people that, for me, unfortunately, President Trump has aligned himself with, at least emotionally, is very scary.
It's an honor to be with you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
During his presidency, Donald Trump maintained a close relationship with Russian President Vladimir Putin. 5 years later, he called him a genius for invading Ukraine. The Washington Post reports that Trump has said he would end the war by pressuring Ukraine to cede land to Russia. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky calls that a primitive idea. At a recent rally, Trump recalled a conversation he had with a country leader, delinquent on NATO payments for Ukraine.
Well, sir, if we don't pay and we're attacked by Russia, will you protect us? I said, no, I would not protect you. In fact, I would encourage them to do whatever the hell they want. You got to pay.
Biden and Trump differ greatly over how to end the war in Ukraine.
President Trump has made a promise to the American people, and they can trust that he will deliver on it, to end the war in Ukraine, to negotiate a peace deal with both sides.
And that's why Isaac Geer of New Hampshire will vote for Trump.
It's really important to me that we stay out of any foreign wars and keep our military spending down.
Meanwhile, a bill to send $60 billion in military aid to Ukraine has stalled in the U.S. House of Representatives. Carolyn Persuti, VOA News.
Ukrainian officials are voicing concern about future military support from the West, especially the United States. Military commanders on the ground in Ukraine say they urgently need additional aid, including advanced weapons, to regain a strategic advantage against the more powerful Russian forces. Eastern Europe Bureau Chief Maryslava Gongadze reports.
The battlefield landscape in eastern Ukraine has significantly worsened in recent days. In a social media post on Saturday, Commander-in-Chief of Ukraine's Armed Forces, Colonel General Oleksandr Sirsky, said the situation on the eastern front has deteriorated as Russia intensified its effort to gain more Ukrainian territory. Faced with shortage of soldiers and ammunition, the Ukrainian parliament last week passed a long-debated bill that will make it easier to identify men who are eligible for the draft. In early April, Ukraine lowered the conscript age from 27 to 25. Officials have expressed concern about Ukraine's ability to keep fighting on the front line and across its territory. Former Education Minister Anna Novosad and her foundation Safe Ed are working to rebuild schools. She says even under constant threats, Ukrainians are undeterred.
No one is going to give up. People are still defiant, and people are defiant about defending their country. And the polls show that a lot of Ukrainians, the prevailing majority of Ukrainians, are not ready to give up an inch of territory.
Miroslava Gongadze, VOA News, Kyiv.
International Edition continues. I'm Scott Walterman. And finally, a bakery in Gaza City has started operating for the first time in 6 months with aid from the World Food Program. Reuters correspondent Angela Johnston says it's providing desperately needed food in a part of the territory where a UN-backed report has warned of imminent famine.
Long lines snaked outside a bakery in Gaza City on Sunday as it started operating again for the first time in 6 months. It reopened with help from the World Food Program and is providing desperately needed food in a part of the territory where the United Nations has warned of imminent famine. Abdul Rahman Al-Jadba scored a bag of bread for his family. He says he had been forced to feed his children bread made with flour mixed with sand.
Our feeling after bread became available, It brought some sense of relief to be able to feed these children, fill the hunger, and be able to move on to the next day, and maybe, God willing, bring more.
Israel's offensive in the Gaza Strip has turned much of the territory into a wasteland, with an unfolding humanitarian catastrophe since October. That's when the militant Islamist group Hamas ignited war by storming southern Israel. Israel has faced increased international pressure to let more aid into the Gaza Strip since it targeted an aid convoy on April 1st, killing international relief workers. The World Food Program says it's been using a new coordinated route to get aid into northern Gaza. It says it was able to make its first delivery to the bakery on Saturday with enough flour to make 14,000 bread parcels a day. A spokesperson said the hope is to expand to three more bakeries and keep up regular deliveries. At home, Al-Jadba says the bakery bread cost about 5 shekels, or just over a dollar. 10 days ago, it would have cost 20 times as much. He says he's praying he can keep getting fresh bread. Israel, which denies hindering humanitarian relief to Gaza, has said that aid is moving into Gaza more quickly. But the amount is disputed, and the United Nations says it is still much less than the bare minimum to meet humanitarian needs.
Reuters correspondent Angela Johnston. This has been International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of everyone here at VOA, thank you so much for joining us. For pictures, stories, videos, and more, follow VOA News on your favorite social media platform and online at voanews.com or download the VOA app. In Washington, I'm Scott Walterman.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The United States reiterates its strong support for the continued implementation of the 2016 peace accord between the Colombian government and two armed rebel groups, the FARC and the ELN, said Ambassador Robert Wood, U.S. Alternate Representative for Special Political Affairs at the United Nations.
Accelerating efforts toward full implementation is vital to Colombia's efforts to make progress for justice for victims of the conflict, alongside its security, stability, and counter-narcotics goals. We welcome continued dialogue between the Colombian government and the ELN, including the sixth round of talks in Cuba.
The U.S. welcomes progress on the implementation of the Comprehensive Rural Reform Program. More must be done to expand access to land, in particular for marginalized ethnic communities, said Ambassador Wood. The U.S. condemns acts of violence perpetrated by the Colombian Revolutionary Armed Forces, or FARC, on March 16th and 17th against indigenous communities in the municipality of Toribio, Cauca, said Ambassador Wood.
In particular, we mourn the death of community leader Carmelina Escuyayul and the wounding of two indigenous guards. According to reports, FARC dissidents attacked her and others following their protest against the armed group's forced recruitment of minors. We also remain greatly concerned by increased violence in regions such as Antioquia, Cauca, Choco, Nariño, and Putumayo that particularly threatens the safety and development of indigenous and Afro-Colombian communities.
The United States will continue to look for more progress on discussions between the Colombian government and the FARC before considering a further expansion of the UN verification mission in Colombia mandate to include monitoring the ceasefire between the FARC and the Colombian government. Unhindered humanitarian access, particularly for humanitarian demining organizations, as well as civilian protections, continues to be of paramount importance. The ELN, FARC, and Segunda Marquetalia remain designated foreign terrorist organizations under U.S. law, and these designations demonstrate the United States' solidarity with Colombia's efforts to support victims as they seek truth. Past peace processes, said Ambassador Wood, have made clear that a security strategy is essential to pressure illegal armed groups to negotiate in good faith and to avoid impunity for their abuses.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States.